Afternoon, may it please the court. I'm Louis Rizzo. I represent appellants, plaintiffs below, Handler and Penn National Insurance Company.
Welcome back.
Thank you, Your Honor. There are two basic premises that Harleysville puts forth to disclaim coverage or avoid coverage in this case. The first is to say that there is no coverage. Coverage is never triggered under the endorsement. And then secondarily, Harleysville claims that the coverage, to the extent it is triggered, is limited by the language within the endorsement. The suggestion that the coverage under the endorsement is not triggered is based on Harleysville's claim that the language in the contract, which states that State Drywall, the subcontractor, will obtain and maintain insurance which fully covers and indemnifies Handler, is somehow deficient or ambiguous and doesn't contain what Harleysville suggests are magic words that must be included, additional insured. The lower court correctly concluded that the language within the contract stating coverage, requiring coverage, which fully indemnifies and covers Handler, was unambiguous and required coverage, that is, State Drywall to obtain coverage for the benefit of Handler.
Now, what's your response to the contention that additional insured is a term of art, and so there's a meaning for that, and that that was not satisfied in this case?
That suggestion may have merit in the insurance context. That is, if we were talking about the language, the decision to include or not include that type of term of art in a policy of insurance by an insurer. But that's not what we're dealing with. What we're dealing with is a contract between a residential home builder and a drywaller subcontractor. And while they may generally be familiar from a business sense of insurance and what it means, that same level of knowledge of specific terms of art, such as a magic language that Harleysville is suggesting in terms of additional insured, would not apply. It should not be applied to what would in essence be a layperson as it relates to proficiency and knowledge of insurance terminology.
But their focus is not on the agreement between the contractors. It's on the policy language, and the extent of coverage is for an additional insured, and that wasn't met.
Well, where they specifically argue about the absence of the term additional insured, they're talking about the contract between the general and the sub, and that is Handler and State. And when Harleysville makes the argument that the words additional insured don't appear, they don't claim that they don't appear in the policy. Indeed, they do appear in Harleysville's own policy. But they claim that it doesn't appear in the insurance requirement, the clause, which appears at within the contract, where it says they'll get coverage which fully covers and indemnifies Handler, but doesn't say and will name them as an additional insured. That's where Harleysville claims that magic language should appear, and that's not an insurance policy, and it's not drafted by an insurance company. It's a construction contract, and it's drafted by a home builder. And so that presence or absence of the magic language of that term of art should not be applied in that instance. That's the first part of the Harleysville claim to avoid coverage, that that language that is in the contract is somehow deficient or ambiguous and doesn't require coverage or trigger the additional insured endorsement.
So how would we ascertain the intent of the parties with regard to this contract? You know, you seem to be saying that the purpose was to make sure no matter what happened, Handler was covered and got a defense. And what we hear from Harleysville is, no, it was a limited form of coverage, and what you got is something that makes us it doesn't apply to us. So how do we differentiate between whether it was permissible to buy limited coverage, for want of a better term, as opposed to the intent of the parties being, we want the most comprehensive coverage, so if something happens, we're sued, we're covered by your insurance. We don't want to be out of pocket any money for either a policy or liability.
Well, the short answer is to look to the language of the contract. There's an underlying question behind the court's question, which is if we get to that insurance coverage that Harleysville says is never triggered, if indeed it is triggered by that language and in the contract, which triggers the additional insured endorsement, what's the scope of that? Is it limited? Part two of Harleysville attempt to avoid coverage. So the first part of the answer to the court's question is the contract language itself is broad and, as the trial court noted, is unambiguous, and it's designed to fully cover and indemnify Handler. And we know from this court's ruling, for example, in Chrysler versus Merrill, that that's an acceptable provision that's enforceable. It's not violative of 2704. It falls within 2704B, the savings provision. It's a concept that's different than the concept of indemnity. The notion of insurance is different and distinct. It does not, the public policy behind avoiding prohibitions against avoiding liability for your own negligence in the construction setting, that is, to encourage liability to be placed upon the people that are at fault so that they make jobs safer, that doesn't attach in the insurance setting, because the person that's ultimately liable is still ultimately liable. They're only covered by insurance to the extent of the insurance. And so those concerns that we have that are behind 2704A don't exist in the insurance setting. And so we know from the Chrysler v. Merrill that it's a permissible and enforceable. We know from Chrysler v. Merrill that there's good policy reasons behind it, public policy. Number one, by allowing that insurance, we're increasing the fund of potential monies available to a victim like the plaintiff in this case who suffered catastrophic injuries. We know from that the additional public policy concern or basis for allowing it, that insurance is purchased and factored into the cost of the bid price, and therefore part of the bargain between the parties, and again mitigates toward allowing such coverage to exist. And then finally, the court's admonishment against the creation of an illusion of coverage. That's the phrase from Chrysler versus Merrill, where they talked about an insurance company collecting premiums, accepting premiums, creating, drafting, and including additional insured endorsements. And then when it comes time for coverage to be claimed under there, to disclaim or avoid coverage, as we're seeing here. And that illusion of coverage that the court more than frowned upon but admonished against in Chrysler versus Merrill, that's precisely what we have here. And when we look at the beyond the contract, which identifies the intent of the parties and the broad scope of coverage, we then look to the additional insured endorsement itself to see, number one, does it comply with the contractual requirements? And number two, what is the scope of coverage permitted? The additional insured endorsement under the Harleysville policy precisely deals with the scenario where, as here, they're a named insured contracted to include the general, or in this case the general contractor, as an insured, an additional insured under the policy. It's specifically tailored for the construction setting, and it's specifically tailored for such agreements. The contract language talks about the fact that this is the contract between Handler and State Drywall, confirms that State Drywall is going to occupy a position as an independent contractor. And what Harleysville contends is the vicarious liability language within the additional insured endorsement. That's the limiting language. So in the initial portion of the endorsement, the coverage is offered, and identified for this scenario, and then it's limited later in the endorsement. And there's two phrases in there. One is it's limited to vicarious liability, and then it goes on to say for liability arising from your work. It specifically says claims which arise from ongoing construction operations of the named insured. How do we address these two phrases within that limiting language? Harleysville contends that they can only be liable for vicarious liability, that is, handlers' vicarious liabilities for states' actions. And one of the things that's at issue here is this court's decision in the Fisher case, where it talked about independent contractor liability, and that, in essence, an independent contractor cannot be vicariously liable for the acts of a contract, another independent contractor. A subset of agency law allows vicarious liability to attach, but in very limited circumstances, and that's discussed by this court in the Fisher case. However, we're in the construction setting, and in the construction setting, we have a body of construction law, and this court discussed it thoroughly in the Lepechko decision, in the case which gives rise to this action.
Do you agree with footnote 15 of the Superior Court's opinion saying that drywall breaches contractual insurance and indemnification obligations to handler in two ways? First, drywall agreed to be solely liable for any loss or damage it caused, and because the Harleysville policy is excess insurance for additional insurers, the Harleysville policy does not provide full coverage for handlers' vicarious liability.
To the extent there is a finding that that coverage is excess, then yes, we would agree with that. That it is our contention on appeal, however, that as we contended below, that the Harleysville coverage is primary or at worst co-primary.
So there's not a breach then?
If there's a finding of primary coverage, then there would not be, then we would agree that state has complied with the unambiguous terms of the contract. Unfortunately, to this point, their carrier, Harleysville, has not accepted coverage, and to the extent there is no coverage, we would contend then that that's a breach of the contract, the enforceable provision of the contract as identified in Chrysler v. Merrill. We have the issue of vicarious liability versus arising from your work. Harleysville attempts to urge the court to accept the notion that vicarious liability is the only way that the additional insured endorsement would be triggered. That is, that it should be limited by to the vicarious liability scenario. That's a legal impossibility in the construction law setting. As the court discussed in the original Lepechko case, the general contractor has no duty in this scenario, none, except for limited exceptions. And none of those exceptions include vicarious liability for acts of its subcontractors. It's not recognized. It's not permitted. A general contractor owes no duty in this setting under Delaware case law, except for the three narrow exceptions that are discussed in the Lepechko case, none of which have application here. And so, indeed, we would need those exceptions if there was an ability to be vicariously liable. If there was a vicarious ability for a general to be vicariously liable for a subcontractor, then there wouldn't be a need to have another means to have a direct claim against the general. There is no vicarious liability of a general contractor for a subcontractor's conduct in the construction setting. So that limiting language in the policy, in the additional insured endorsement that includes vicarious liability, creates that illusion of coverage that this court admonished against in Chrysler versus Merrill. It's an impossibility if we follow the analysis and the reasoning that Harleysville is urging upon the court. Quite simply, every time this scenario arises, there will be the ability of Harleysville or similar situated insurers to disclaim coverage, because there can never satisfy that limiting language if we are focused and follow the analysis of vicarious liability. What other courts have done and what is the only way to give effect to this additional insured endorsement so that it's more than a mere illusion of coverage is to focus on the arising from its work language. If it rises from the construction activities, and the courts, and we cite the Anderson case in our papers, and that discusses cases from Texas and Massachusetts and elsewhere that talk about arising from work or arising from your construction activities, and they talk about how that is not a proximate cause from a negligence viewpoint that satisfies that, but it's a more general causal relationship that is not one that needs to establish negligence and proximate cause on the part of the subcontractor. And so when we focus on that language and we take that analysis that courts have done on whether or not this arose from the work, we reach the conclusion that the trial court did, that coverage is triggered, handler is an additional insured under the policy and entitled to indemnity and defense. And it's entitled to indemnity and defense on a primary basis. The contract requires the handler to be fully covered and indemnified. And that language, that policy, the Penn National policy that's in effect, contains primary and, other insurance or excess insurance clause. That other insurance clause specifically deals with the additional insured endorsement scenario that we have here. And that the language in the Harleysville policy is much more broad or general. And when confronted with these two, we urge the court to follow the general rule of construction that the specific should trump, if you will, the general language. Harleysville suggests that their excess, because they're excess, they suggest we're an excess policy. Penn National says they're excess over primary policies. Well, that's not us. We're not primary. We're excess. It's a circular argument. And I would urge the court to take a look at the record at A66, which is a portion of the other insurance clause from the Harleysville policy, and it begins with the phrase, when we are excess, we will do such and such. That very language acknowledges that sometimes they're going to be excess and sometimes they're going to be primary, and it depends on the language. And that's what we ask the court to do, compare the excess insurance clauses in each policy and make the determination regarding either primary or co-primary based on that. I'll reserve, with the court's permission, the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Very well. Yes, Serena, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court. There are two separate contracts. Let me talk about the insurance policy first. If the court concludes, as the lower court did, that Handler is an additional insured under the Harleysville policy, you have to look at the Harleysville policy. This is an endorsement, a specific endorsement. It is an endorsement that we see more and more, which clearly states that we will provide coverage for vicarious liability. However, and it's clear, any coverage provided here under shall be excess over any other valid and collectible insurance available to the additional insured, whether that additional other insurance is primary, excess, contingent, or provided on any other basis. We will provide coverage, but it's excess. It's excess to any other insurance. The Penn National policy, on the other hand, is primary. It says it's primary, and it says, however, we are excess if and only if there is other primary insurance, and there is no other primary insurance if this policy is in effect. So the lower court said correctly that if this policy is in effect, and it said that it was, Harleysville is an excess carrier. There is no reason to provide coverage here because there is no excess. And that's the only way there can be insurance under this particular policy. The court said that it is unambiguous. It is clearly excess. There is no duty to defend when the policy is excess. It says it in the Hardeesville policy on A116, that when this insurance is excess, and this is what Mr. Rizzo wanted to refer to, we will have no duty under the business liability coverage to defend. It is excess when there's an additional insured. There's no duty to defend. So it really doesn't matter for purposes of the appeal whether we are an insured or not an insured, or whether Handler's an insured or not an insured under the policy. Even if they are an insured under the policy, there's no coverage for this case. Because we are excess, they haven't gotten to excess, there's no duty to defend because the policy says that. Now, with regard to this vicarious liability, Handler has never been sued for vicarious liability in this case. It has always been sued for its own negligence. The Superior Court made it clear that there is no vicarious liability in this case, and that portion I don't think was appealed. The jury made it clear that there's no liability on the part of Vallejo, who's a subcontractor for us. It didn't do anything to cause negligence. Even Handler argued below that it was not liable vicariously for the conduct of State Drywall because it's an independent contractor. Now, Mr. Rizzo says, well, wait a minute, you can never have vicarious liability. We have it all the time. Anytime a contractor controls the work, he's vicariously liable for the acts of the subcontractor. Anytime that subcontractor is the agent or acting as the agent of a general or anybody else, they're responsible vicariously. Anytime there's dangerous activity, they're liable vicariously. We see it all the time. We defend them all the time. If there is an allegation that it is the conduct of the contract of the subcontractor that causes liability to the general contractor, that wasn't alleged here. It wasn't part of the case here. And even this court said when the Telepcio case was appealed, the only basis of liability against Handler is if it assumed safety on the job with regard to these railings, but didn't carry out that properly. That's nothing to do with us. Our people denied even putting the rails up or taking them down, saying they weren't even there, and apparently the jury concluded that. So there is no vicarious liability in this case, and what the court below said was, without vicarious liability, there's no obligation to indemnify. That part of the court's decision is correct. The second contract is the one that Mr. Rizzo also talks about, is the contract between Handler and State Drywall. Now, here is where we have a problem. Handler says, well, this agreement says that you're named insured. Well, it doesn't say we're named insured. And that is a term of art, and it's a term that everybody in the contract industry understands. You see these policies all the time, these contracts all the time, that say we are to be named as an additional insured under your policy, and we want a certificate. We want to see a certificate of insurance stating that. That's not done here. They have this language that says, "Well, you will indemnify us. You will indemnify us. We want you to indemnify us." I forget how the language worded fully and completely. But when you look at the entire language, the entire contract, what it says is, "You subcontractor, State Drywall, must provide general liability insurance, workers' compensation insurance, property insurance, and automobile insurance, all of which will indemnify Handler." Certainly, that's what we got. We have insurance policies that protect Handler in case it is sued as a result of our negligence. There's no question about that. But Handler wants the next step. It wants to say, well, no, this language means you have to indemnify us for the consequences of our negligence. And the policy doesn't say that, or the contract doesn't say that. Indemnity simply means that I will indemnify you for a loss suffered as a result of some third party. So if I agree to indemnify you, Your Honor, you're damaged somehow as a result of something I do or maybe something someone else does, I will compensate you under the indemnity agreement. But if you go out and damage someone I don't agree to compensate to, unless it clearly says that. And the courts have said that. Well, I cited numerous cases that say that.
Because I must be looking at the wrong thing. I'm looking at what I think is the contract between Handler and Drywall that says subcontractor, that would be Drywall,
correct,
right, at all times shall fully indemnify, protect, and hold harmless the company, its agents, yada, yada, from damage, expense, including attorney's fees, all claims, liabilities resulting from accident, negligence, including the company's negligence or any other cause. Doesn't that clearly say it?
Yes, but that's not the clause we're talking about.
Oh, okay.
That is the indemnity clause, not the insurance clause.
Okay.
The indemnity clause, I think, has been conceded, is void in Delaware with regard to
because
indemnity.
Because it purports to
indemnify for their own negligence.
Their own negligence, okay.
Now, that's clear. I mean, that spells out pretty clearly what they want us to do. But the insurance clause, which is a couple in front of that, simply says we will obtain insurance, that is, the subcontractor will obtain insurance, which will fully cover and indemnify Handler, which I submit we've done by getting a liability policy. It's, but we did not agree to fully indemnify them for the consequences of their own negligence. There's a case in Delaware that talks about this. It's Judge Taylor's decision in Laughlin versus Delmarva. In that particular case, and that was decided before the statute, but in that case, the parties had agreed that they would there would be an indemnification. It was an indemnification agreement. But the court said that indemnification agreement was not crystal clear and unequivocal. Therefore, you cannot indemnify the general contractor for the consequences of its own negligence. And then the court said, if there's an insurance provision that requires that, that's void as well, because it wasn't clear, crystal clear, that you're going to indemnify for the consequences of your own negligence. And I submit that's what they're trying to do. I also would ask the court to consider, and the court hasn't ruled on this yet, whether you can force a subcontractor to purchase indemnity insurance to indemnify a contractor for the consequences of its own negligence. We have a statute that forbids the doing that. And in the Merrill and Garagusco case, the court concluded, as I read the decision, that once you obtain insurance, an insurance company cannot deny coverage. But it did not discuss, can you force a subcontractor to obtain liability insurance?
Well, aren't we really blending two concepts in a rather awkward way? If we look at indemnification in the abstract, and you and I have an indemnification agreement, and you're going to indemnify me, I'm counting on you to come up with the wherewithal to indemnify me from whatever resources you have. And then you may want to purchase insurance that's going to provide the money for you to do the indemnification. But the concepts are different. And if you're going to buy insurance that's going to cover me directly, then while it may discharge your indemnification obligation because you're not on the hook for anything because you've bought insurance that's going to cover me, we look at the insurance contract. But aren't they really different concepts?
They are different concepts. absolutely. When you have a contract that says, I will indemnify you, that's a binding contract, providing it does not indemnify you for the consequences of your own negligence.
Right.
Yeah, no problem. And that doesn't even come into play here because they're not being sued for that. They're being sued for the consequences of their own negligence. But what they've done in this contract is saying, okay, we want – what they're saying, and we don't think it says that, what they're saying is we want you, subcontractor, to buy us insurance that will protect us from the consequences of our own negligence. Now, can they do that, which is indirectly something they can't do directly? Directly, they cannot force us to indemnify them for the consequences of their own negligence. And I'm saying they can't do it directly either. Now, there is a decision, of course.
Does that assume such coverage is available? Could you purchase that?
That's my next thing I was going to say. I'm not sure you can. I assume we can buy insurance naming them as an insured and pay for their insurance policy. But can we buy insurance that will protect our insurance policy to protect them from the consequences of their negligence? I'm not sure you can. You obviously cannot from Harleysville. I don't recall seeing an ISO policy that does that because most of them have this vicarious liability provision in it. But there might be some out there, but I haven't seen them, and I don't know the answer to that. But you can from Harleysville. So I'm not even sure you can do that. But I'm suggesting that that would be void in any event.
The Superior Court said the court finds that the parties intended the drywall purchase insurance to cover and indemnify a handler. You're saying that's clearly wrong?
I am, and I think that's the best way I filed the cross appeal.
And that's simply based on the language of the contract, or was there any parole evidence or anything?
No, it's just the language of the contract, Your Honor. That contractual language, I submit, in order for that to provide that we have to indemnify them for the consequences of their own negligence, must say that. Otherwise, we're just simply getting an insurance policy to indemnify them for our negligence. And that's the step that's missing. And I don't think it's magic words. I think it takes more than that because those policies are going to be a little different than a standard insurance policy or an insurance policy where someone is named as an additional insured.
But that goes back to my question to Mr. Rizzo. If we could fathom the intent of the parties, let's assume that Handler intended for Rizzo's client to buy the let's assume that what Mr. Rizzo's client wanted was coverage that would be primary, and to the extent they could get primary coverage from a subcontractor, in the long run, their own premiums would go down. Would you have any problem with that as a matter of law if it clearly said, we want to be insured at your expense, subcontractor, from anything that you or we do, and we want you to buy insurance that's primary for both of us?
I have seen those provisions in a contract, I'll be honest with the court. But they spell that out in real clear language that that's much clearer than this. This language doesn't say that at all. But, yes, I have seen contracts where one party will say, we want you to purchase insurance, that insurance will cover us and be primary. That's
And what
possible.
You're saying is that when people like Handler have a provision that we have before us today, and the subcontractor goes to Harleysville would say something to the effect, okay, we understand they want coverage, but they already have their own coverage. So what they're really trying to do is get you to provide supplemental or secondary coverage so at the end of the day they have no responsibility, no loss, and that's what Harleysville provided in this case.
I don't think it's quite that I don't think that's what happens in reality. What happens in reality is the general contractor will say, I need to see a copy of a certificate of insurance.
But what they're really looking for is to see that you have insurance that will respond on their behalf. But it seems like Harleysville view is when we're asked to provide that, we always respond second. We're not going to be primary for the general contractor.
Harleysville does not write a primary policy for an additional insured. If it's an additional insured, it's excess. Everyone is still protected because the general liability has liability coverage. Now, normally, they get a copy of our certificate so they know what we have. That's the way it should be done, and they can look at it and say, if this isn't right, we want something else.
So in this situation, they would have said, well, wait a minute. You've got a policy that only responds on our behalf in an excess capacity. That's not what we want. We want you to buy primary coverage for us.
If that's what they want, I'm sure they would come back to us. But that's not really what happens in this business. In reality, what happens is you see a contract that hardly anybody ever reads, and they're form contracts for the most part. They all have these indemnity provisions in them, which have been illegal in Delaware now for years. But
if we rule in your favor as a general proposition, affirming what the Superior Court did, Do we have to reach the cross appeal? And if we did, would we basically be giving an advisory opinion? Or?
If the court affirms the lower court, you would have concluded that the Harleysville policy, that the contract required that state drywall be an additional insured, and that under that policy there is no coverage because it's only excess,
right,
and that there is no liability for indemnity because there is no vicarious liability. We'd be content with that, obviously, because we win the case. My concern was, and that's why I filed a cross appeal, that I really don't think we are. I don't think that's correct, that we are an additional insured. I don't think the policy language says that. Not the policy language, the contract language.
But if you affirm, if we affirm the Superior Court on the first two points, your cross appeal basically becomes dicta.
It's correct. It's basically
moot.
And
it's not something we have to reach to decide the two issues that we would be affirming on.
That's correct. But if you were to go back and say the lower court was wrong, I would ask you to say, well, in that case, we are not an insured under this we're not required to get indemnification policy contract policy to provide coverage for them.
Right. If it went back, that would lead to a factual dispute. I understand we've had these prior cases and this, but there would still be an issue on whether Handler was responding for its own negligence or vicariously responding. But to the extent it was responding, the policy was responding on behalf of Handler's own negligence, you would say that was an invalid provision to make that type of coverage be purchased.
Correct. But I wasn't even arguing the point that this policy would disclaim for vicarious liability.
Right.
I'm simply saying that this policy is an excess policy.
I understand that.
Yeah, Mr. Rizzo said, "Well, we're disclaiming because of the vicarious liability. We're disclaiming the indemnity portion, where the judge said, under the contract, we have to indemnify them." But then the judge went back and looked at it and says, "Well, no, that's not true because there is no vicarious liability here, and therefore that was an error on my part." And that's why we filed the re-argument. So to answer your question, and if you affirm it, the insurance company is content. But we still think the lower court was wrong when it made that analogy.
Well, that would give us something to do in the future.
Perhaps. I have nothing else then.
The court asked about and counsel commented on what typically happens and how these are treated elsewhere. I would suggest to the court that what typically happens is these additional insured endorsements are honored by the insurers, like the insurer of Mr. Lepechko's employer, who did tender their policy limits to Handler under the same contract language with the same policy endorsement language. That's a very typical scenario, and that was done to comply with the terms of the contract, the intent of the parties, and the language of the policy. It's not unusual. It's commonplace, and it reflects the expectations of the parties. This sort of shifting of insurance costs and risks is a very common part of these. One could envision the scheme where the general purchased no insurance and had those insurance obligations flow outward. In that case, we don't get to the primary excess analysis at all because there is no coverage to be excess to. It's not an excess policy, the Harleysville policy. It's a primary policy with an excess or other insurance provision. And that's the key difference. Indemnity versus insurance, a critical distinction. We're not talking about contractual indemnity. We're talking about insurance coverage, a component of which is indemnification under a policy. But the concerns about indemnity are different when we're talking about insurance coverage and the indemnity that might attach there too. The notion that a general contractor can be vicariously liable, and that's what was addressed in other case law, not correct. What was addressed was duty, the presence or absence of a duty, not vicarious liability. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rizzo.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cancerino. The court will take this matter under advisement, and we will adjourn.
Rise.